Imagine a world where we actually listen to Black women. When we do, we can see how the technological ecosystems built by Black feminists over centuries of creatively surviving overwhelming oppression can give rise to new digital spaces that counter the toxic patriarchal hegemony. A new book from Dr. Catherine Knight Steele lays out the arguments in favor of centering digital Black feminism with regard to technology.
Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like linguistics, technology, game and object design, and ethics. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
We're joined today by Dr. Catherine Knight Steele, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Maryland, College Park. Dr. Steele was the founding director of the African American Digital Humanities Initiative and currently directs the Black Communication and Technology Lab as part of the Digital Inquiry, Speculation, Collaboration, and Optimism Network.
Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's absolutely great to be here.
I am so curious about your work, both your current position and the program that you founded at the University of Maryland.
So I'll give you a little teaser about each one of those. I came to Maryland about 6 years ago to direct the African American Digital Humanities Initiative, which was a Mellon-funded grant, and it was the first of its kind program in the U.S. that merged the areas of African American history and culture with digital humanities. And the goal of that project was really to start a network of scholars and scholarship at that intersection and to provide real grounded support for students, for faculty, and also community members who were already doing things like creating their own digital archives. So that was a fantastic 3 years of working with students and faculty, some of whom had never touched digital things before, some of whom had only touched digital things before, but had not thought about the way that Black theory and thought and Black studies could really change the kinds of questions they were asking and really open them up to new possibilities in their work. And after finishing my tour of duty with AdHume, we had a big national conference, the first conference in Black digital humanities in the U.S. I then was really excited to begin work with the DISCO Network. You have to love that acronym, right? So this is a fairly new network that's founded by Lisa Nakamura out of University of Michigan, who is really one of the architects of internet studies. And I get to run the BCAT lab, or the Black Communication and Technology Lab, and do some of the work that AdHume was doing, but also widen our scope a bit to include some social scientists and information scientists who also might be curious about those intersections. And what I'm trying to do now is build a pipeline that people can take at other universities that really brings students all the way from high school to the professoriate in thinking about race and technology, and specifically thinking about Black history and culture as a part of that. The most exciting thing about the DISCO Network to me is the O, which is the optimism part. Very often we think about race and technology in very dismal ways, and we think about oppression and we think about racism, and these are really important topics. But our network is really committed to the optimism part of seeing how human beings do amazing things in the hardest of circumstances.
So when you say that you want a pipeline of people that are from high school to the professorial, what's the end result there? Is this people that are going to go out and do startups, or is this people that are going to teach or do research?
All of the above, yeah. Also, we noticed that there are folks who are missing in all these spaces. And just to name it, our university, University of Maryland, is in College Park. It's in Prince George's County, which is a predominantly Black county. But our school is very low number of Black students that come in at the undergraduate level, and even lower number that come in and stay through in our field. And what we want to show folks is that there are possibilities in the humanities to do really interesting, important work with technology, that it's not simply STEM fields. It's not just computer science. And those are great fields, but those aren't the only options for our students. And so we want students who are interested in things like justice and activism, but also potentially interested in going to corporate spaces and doing ethical work in Twitter, right? And working on big name apps to get their start by really thinking about how these things impact themselves and their communities. And what better place than the humanities to learn those things?
One of the things, and I think it's in the introduction to your book, that even if we get all these young Black women coding, so what? They're going to go and be immersed in some sort of toxic culture that's not taking these things into account.
I think what ties, hopefully, some of the work that I'm trying to do with the BCAT Lab and AdHume to the book is we think about coding and technology in really specific ways. And we think of these as technical skills that certain groups lack, and therefore we need to teach to them in order to make them a part of our economic superstructure, right? And I wondered at the start of this book, well, what happens if we actually think about the expertise that individuals and communities already have as a result of their long trajectory in this country? What technical expertise is being overlooked as we demand specifically that Black students learn more coding or learn more about how to get jobs in the tech field? We're actually acting as though there is a dearth of knowledge on the part of Black individuals in this area, and evidence just doesn't bear that out. So I hope that while we do encourage people to pursue all of the goals that, you know, might be of interest to them, we open the door to thinking about the fact that there are other forms of technical and technological expertise that we have really ignored for a long time.
So in a sense, are you talking about almost a bias that exists in terms of what we think of as a technically sophisticated skill?
Absolutely. It's a long-term built-in, baked-in bias that I think all of us have. It's been really well done, I think, is the point of erasing our knowledge. And by our, I mean the knowledge of women, the knowledge of people of color who have had technical skills in a variety of areas until that was no longer considered technical, until it became domestic work, until it became pink-collar work, low-skilled labor, right? Minimum wage jobs. And we call them these things in order to diminish the impact and the amount of expertise necessary to master these skill sets. And this happened at really specific moments in our history, and I would argue for really specific reasons, in order to have technology fall to certain individuals who could find profit from it. So we watch this happen during chattel slavery. We watch this happen as women are moved out of positions of experts and knowledge makers within the home, right? These are intentional things. It wasn't an accident that we've landed in a place where we no longer believe that certain individuals have capacities to be technological ingenues.
You said pink collar. I actually have not heard that term before.
So pink collar jobs are jobs that women tend to have in higher numbers than men in our economy. So things like nursing skills, teaching, for example, gets labeled as a pink collar job. And when these pink collar jobs get labeled as such, we diminish the skill sets that are associated with them, right? So teaching becomes something anyone can do. But when we have programs that suggest, oh, anyone can teach in an inner city, I think a lot of research shows the reason that that happens is because women tend to fill those professions.
You said that there is this sort of bias against skill sets that in the modern era would not be considered, quote, technical, end quote. So can you give some just examples of what would be skill sets that you consider to be highly technical or require like a lot of mastery?
In the book, I talk a bit about this in the intro about agricultural labor and agricultural knowledge and expertise. So there is a running kind of thought that the reason that folks were enslaved was because we needed low-skilled workers to do this work. But the opposite of that is true. Folks who were going to the continent of Africa and kidnapping people were kidnapping folks who had really high skill sets that were required in order to make an economy function. They were kidnapping human beings who had mastered things like growing rice that folks here didn't know how to do. They simply couldn't make it work. So they needed people who knew how to do this work, who knew how to do it effectively and efficiently, and were already very capable at it. And so if it were the case that enslaved Black people had no skills or low skills, they would not have been enslaved for the periods of time that they were. They would not have been the blacksmiths. They would not have been the folks who were cultivating the crops. They would not be the folks who were responsible for creating cotton gins and creating ironing boards and creating the domestic kind of tools that were necessary for households and plantations to function. So we've done this kind of weird mental trickery to ourselves where we've told ourselves that the reason that people were in these positions is because they didn't have skill sets. Today, when I watch folks do that work, there's no way I could master that, right? It's not possible.
If it was so easy to grow a garden, everybody would have one. I can kill any plant.
Absolutely. That persists. And I think that we've also taken away the technological skill of oratory as well, right? And the way that people learned new language, created new language, created hidden discourses and languages, that's technical expertise, right? The ability to speak in front of someone and not have them have no idea what you're saying so that you stay alive in that environment requires a really high skill set in terms of oratory.
What do you mean by a hidden discourse?
There's a lot of work that folks talk about in terms of the way that when enslaved persons from the continent of Africa were brought to the U.S., had to learn multiple languages, multiple ways of speaking and communicating, both with other enslaved individuals, but also with the folks who were the enslavers. And so they developed hidden discourses and languages where they could communicate things to each other openly that were not understood by the folks who, if they found out, could result in punishment, death, violence against their bodies. What I think is marvelous about studying Black feminist rhetoric is that what Black women were doing this twice over. They were simultaneously hiding discourses from the enslavers who were white at that time, but also from men. They were finding ways to be involved in multiple communities at once and survive in each one of those communities, to provide expertise without too much expertise so that it didn't result in even more labor. This really interesting balance and dance and art and skill that often gets muddied over and ignored in our history books.
All this study and all this research, is this coming out of your work with DISCO, or is this part of a longer term body of research?
DISCO's pretty new. We just formed in April. The folks that are involved in the DISCO network, these are folks who I was reading about in graduate school that I now get to work with. I'm living the dream. Ray Fouché and Andre Brock and Lisa Nakamura, who just were amazing innovators in thinking about digital technology, race, Blackness, Black vernacular technological creativity, which is a term from Ray Fouché, one that I really enjoy and love. I've been writing about online technology and Black discourse since 2007, 2008. And at that time, the landscape was very different. It was very hard to find anyone else doing that work. And those of us who were really just trying to say, we're here. That was the entry point that we had, was simply to say our literature right now suggests that Black people are not online and are deficient in their use of technology. That was the predominating idea in our field at that time. So there was a lot of the talk about we need to get more computers into the inner city. We need to teach Black people skill sets. We still hear a lot of that, right? But that was it. That was all that was there. And it was such a mismatch to what my lived experience was that I simply at the start of graduate school said, I just have to write down what we're doing because I don't know that everyone knows that there are vibrant Black communities online doing really cool things.
When you say that your personal experience was different, can you provide some examples?
When I left undergrad, I was working in brand management and I was selling commercials for brand leaders. You know, I won't name their names. But while I was doing that, it was such a shock to my system because I was back in my hometown of Chicago, but my day-to-day life involved seeing almost no one that looked like me. And it was the first time in a long time that that had been the case. And instead, what I found myself doing in my cubicle was delving online into the world of the Black blogosphere, which was very rich and very vibrant in 2008 and 2009 and 2007. there were these communities of people who were having similar experiences to me and talked the way that I did, but also had the same kind of jobs that I did and the same kind of educational background that I did. And we were all just kind of at work on the blog, living this other life. And it was a place where people were talking about everything under the sun, from hair care to the presidential race at the time to what we watched on TV last night. But what I was realizing is what we were doing in those spaces was not so different than what we'd always done as Black folks, which is find places for discourse to talk about the things that matter to our everyday life while simultaneously building community and advancing public political agendas. So conversations about hair care turned into conversations about policy. Conversations about mothering turned into conversations about who we're voting for and how to mobilize for that candidate. And this is exactly what has always happened historically in Black churches, in Black barber shops, in beauty shops, on the corner, at the kitchen table, places that exist for Black folks outside of the gaze of the dominant group. And that's what was happening online that I was drawn to as just a person who needed that. And then, oh, I'm in grad school. I can write about this.
So following bloggers back in the misty past of 2008, that actually led to your dissertation.
It did. So my dissertation was called The Digital Barbershop, and I tracked Black blogs. I intentionally didn't look at political blogs that were named political. I looked at blogs that were lifestyle blogs and humor blogs and mommy blogs and hair blogs, and made the argument that these were the places where ideology was formed, where people changed their minds, where people became active citizens and advanced agendas that were important for their families and their communities, and that these places were intentionally hidden. They weren't counterpublics that were visible. They were what Catherine Squires calls enclaves and satellite publics. And I love her work on that because while counterpublics is a really useful term in a lot of ways, it doesn't describe the reasons and the ways that sometimes people gather outside of the view of others and why they have to do that, and historically why it's mattered to have those really private, separate spaces to create new arguments that they can test out among each other before they're forced to use them in public.
I think that the nomenclature of enclave is a really good one. And I would suggest that I think that applies to almost any marginalized community.
Absolutely.
And, you know, whether it's ethnic or based on gender identification. And I think that's the way that people roll. Catherine, thank you so much for being with us today. It's a real treat.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
And if you would like more information about Dr. Steele and her book, Digital Black Feminism, visit CatherineKnightSteele.com. And that's Catherine with a C, Knight with a K-N, STEELE.com. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan
Klum. So you can
Klum.
Find me just sitting at my crossroads waiting for the light to change, and the same familiar faces come on.